From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The Federal Communications Commission is presently considering a change in its rules that would allow for a spectacular increase in media consolidation in the United States in the coming years. It's an increase that would make all previous moves towards concentration in media or any other industry look like mere child's play. This is the year in which this will take place, and unless citizens act and act soon, it will be a done deal.
Fox, NBC, Viacom, Walt Disney urge the government to scrap all remaining media ownership rules. We'll have a debate between a spokesperson for the FCC and media critics Bob McChesney and Jeff Chester. But first, we'll talk to Ralph Nader about the Democrats who've lined up for the 2004 presidential election. And we'll look at Congress opening today. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations is now estimating a U.S. war against Iraq would cause 2 million Iraqis to become refugees, and a total of 10 million would be put at risk of hunger and disease. This according to a report in the Washington Post. U.N. officials are warning that the impact of a U.S. invasion of Iraq would likely be far worse than the humanitarian crisis caused by the Gulf War in 1991. A decade of UN sanctions has made the Iraqi population almost totally dependent on government handouts for survival. Meanwhile, in Iraq, Saddam Hussein accused UN inspectors of spying instead of searching for weapons of mass destruction. He also said Iraq would prevail if the U.S. attacked. And in related news, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency is reporting nuclear inspectors in Iraq have found nothing suspicious and that the agency has no evidence that Iraq lied in its declarations on nuclear arms. Today in Chicago, President-elect Bush plans to unveil his $674 billion economic plan. The centerpiece of the plan will be the elimination of all taxes on corporate dividends paid to shareholders, which could cost $300 billion over the next decade. Bush stunned lawmakers in both parties with the plan. It's twice as expensive as most had been expecting and overwhelmingly favors the wealthy. The Tax Policy Center calculates the wealthiest 1% of all taxpayers will receive 42% of the savings from making dividends to shareholders tax-free. Bush's announcement comes on the heels of reports that the Bush administration wants to freeze all domestic spending programs except for Homeland Security. White House officials say the spending cap on welfare, the environment, job creation, and other government programs is needed to put the budget on a war footing. Democrats attack the plan, saying it's for the wealthiest people in the country. Yesterday, they unveiled a much smaller alternative that would provide $136 billion through tax rebates, aid to state governments, and expanded unemployment benefits. In Washington, more than 300,000 Native Americans filed claims yesterday that the federal government had cheated them out of as much as $137.2 billion over the last 115 years. The filing comes as part of a class action suit that charges the government lost or stole millions of dollars earned on tribal lands. As the Bush administration continues to talk of unilaterally imposing sanctions against North Korea, Democratic Senator from Michigan, Carl Levin, has advised Bush to listen to his wife and to tone down his message. On Fox over the weekend, Levin said of the administration, quote, "They've used the rhetoric of this type, this kind of unilateralist, aggressive rhetoric in other places. And that's why Laura Bush, the president's wife, the first lady of this country, on the record has told her husband, tone it down, darling." Levin went on to say, and you know what? I think the administration would do well to listen to Laura Bush. Tone it down, darlings. The rhetoric is too hot, he said, in too many places of the world. It's great that we're strong, that we're the world's only superpower, but we've got to use that wisely and not use the rhetoric, which is so inflammatory. Meanwhile, North Korea warned the United States it will consider economic sanctions a declaration of war. The announcement came on the same day that the UN International Atomic Energy Agency decided not to refer the North Korean nuclear situation to the full UN Security Council. And this news from the occupied territories. Israel has confined all Palestinians under the age of 35 from leaving the West Bank or Gaza Strip. And senior Palestinian officials are now being barred from leaving their own city or town. In addition, the Israeli Navy imposed a blockade on the Gaza coast, forbidding fishermen to go out into the Mediterranean. 2 days ago, a double suicide bombing killed 23 people in Tel Aviv. In related news, Israeli officials are in Washington seeking $12 billion in emergency aid from the United States to boost the Israeli economy and its military. Republican officials have chosen New York to be the site of the 2004 GOP National Convention. Its backdrop, 9-1-1, as one headline put it, dream site for image makers. And finally, maybe Till Mobley has died. She's the mother of Emmett Till, whose 1955 race-motivated killing became a catalyst for the civil rights movement. Mamie Till Mobley was 81 years old. She died Monday of heart failure at Chicago's Jackson Park Hospital. In an Associated Press article last month, Mamie Till Mobley said she remained haunted by the Mississippi killing of her 14-year-old son. An all-white jury acquitted half-brothers J.W. Milam and Roy Bryant in the black teenager's death, though Look magazine published an article with their confession 4 months later. Quote, "I've been trying to get that case reopened since 1956, said Mobley, who traveled the country speaking about the case. She said, people have told me to let this thing die, even people in my own family, but people need to be aware. Emmett Till was vacationing in Money, Mississippi on August 24, 1955, when he allegedly whistled at a white woman. The Associated Press said that Emmett Till from Chicago, that Mamie Till Mobley, his mother, said he'd been naive and didn't understand the reality of lynchings at the time, though she had warned him. 4 days after the so-called wolf whistle, Till was abducted from his uncle's home. His battered 14-year-old body was found with a bullet hole in the head 3 days later in the Tallahatchie River. It was submerged with a cotton gin fan. The trial drew international attention. More than 100 news reporters were in attendance. Civil rights leaders credit both Emmett Till and Mamie Till Mobley with helping to spark the movement that ended Jim Crow segregation laws and passed the Civil Rights Act.
The news and managed to update the boots. Those who left this war. Yeah, the technology has changed, but the thinking's still the same as in all the other wars that we've ever fought before. So we're yelling for more. Yelling for war.
You're listening to Democracy Now.
Alice Brown, he lived on the outside of town. Alice Brown, he lived on the outside of town. Oh, with his wife and 5 children in his cabin broken down. He looked for work in Monday and he walked a ragged mile. Oh, he looked for work in Monday again, and he walked a ragged mile. Oh, your children are so hungry that they don't know how to smile. Your baby's eyes look crazy now, just tugging at your sleeve. Baby's eyes look crazy now, just tugging at your sleeve. Oh, you walk the floor and wonder why, with every breath you breathe. He prayed to the Lord above.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President-elect Bush unveils his $674 billion economic plan today in Chicago. The centerpiece of the plan, the elimination of all taxes on corporate dividends paid to shareholders. It could cost $300 billion over the next 10 years. Bush stunned lawmakers in both parties with the plan. It's twice as expensive as most have been expecting and overwhelmingly favors the wealthy. The Tax Policy Center calculates the wealthiest 1% of all taxpayers will receive 42% of the savings from making the dividends to shareholders tax-free. Bush's announcement comes on the heels of reports he's seeking to freeze all domestic spending programs except for Homeland Security. White House officials say the spending cap on welfare, the environment, job creation, and other government programs is needed to put the budget on a war footing. Democrats attack the plan, saying it's for the wealthiest people in the country. Today, the 108th Congress commences with Republicans in control of the Senate and the House. Senator Bill Frist of Tennessee is the new Senate Majority Leader. Trent Lott was forced to resign from his Senate leadership position after he said the U.S. would be better off if Strom Thurmond had been elected president in 1948 when he ran on the Segregation Forever platform. But according to an article buried in the back of the A section of the New York Times, Senator Lott will be offered the chairmanship of the Senate Rules and Administration Committee this week. And a number of Democratic hopefuls are putting out their name to run for president in 2004. Of the congressional ones who have come forward, John Kerry and looks like Joseph Lieberman might also throw in his hat. Richard Gephardt and all of them, John Andrews as well, all of them have, John Edwards as well, have taken a stand for war. Right now we turn to Ralph Nader. He also ran for president in the Green Party platform to talk about the state of the nation today. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ralph Nader.
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Well, why don't we start off with what the president is going to be doing today, announcing the new tax package?
Well, he's going to be furthering establishing the power of the plutocracy, as one commentator called it, a runaway plutocracy, the rule by the rich and powerful. There aren't many economists who think what he's doing by way of these tax cuts for the wealthy are going to do anything except make the wealthy wealthier. Certainly he's not going to do anything for public investment, which is being seriously deprived. Building and maintaining our health clinics and mass transit and other public works, which will create jobs where they are being constructed, especially in the inner city. And it certainly doesn't do anything for the people who have children, including themselves, who don't have health care. And it certainly doesn't do anything about living wage. One of the ways you can increase demand, economic demand in this country, is to bring the minimum wage up to what it would have been if it was indexed to inflation since 1968, as members of Congress have done for their salaries. And that minimum wage would be now about $8 an hour, instead of the federal minimum wage being $5.15 an hour. So he knows what needs to be done to increase economic demand for necessities on the part of millions of Americans who either don't have jobs or who work every day and can't make a living wage. But he's going the way of the plutocracy. And that would, in the past, have been political suicide. But in a contemporary political era, it was the Democrats in June 2001, having just taken control of the Senate, who let the massive Bush tax cut go through the Senate. And again and again, the Democrats are opposing what they allowed to get go through the Congress in the first place.
Well, talking about the people who have put themselves forward possibly as presidential candidates, North Carolina Senator John Edwards, Richard Gephardt, outgoing House Minority Leader, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, it may be Connecticut Senator Joseph Lieberman joins in. These are those who are coming from the House and the Senate. All of them are for war, supporting Bush on war. As you talk about what's the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans, there is Howard Dean, the former Vermont governor. He's just leaving as Vermont governor. There is Al Sharpton. They both are against the invasion of Iraq. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, it's interesting. Not only do they support the war, these presidential candidates for the Democrats, but they surrendered the congressional authority to declare war. This is a very serious matter. You remember last year, Bush asked for a war resolution from Congress that was so broadly worded that, in effect, took away the congressional authority to declare war in the Iraq and penumbral areas of the Middle East and gave it to the president. And the president makes no bones about it. He said on a number of occasions, I will decide when this country goes to war. So it's not only a policy abdication, as if they have any idea of what the consequences will be of going to war in the Middle East, because the whole premise of the war hawks on the Iraq situation is that it's going to be a two-week cakewalk. The government will be toppled. They'll put a provisional government in, and democracy will start to flower. Well, there are a lot of former military generals and admirals who disagree with that. General Zinni, for example, thinks that this is a very inappropriate foreign policy move, saying again and again that the government of the United States has more important priorities in the Middle East, including settling the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And the Washington Post in October reported General Zinni's remarks, and in the last paragraph said that the majority, not all, but the majority of retired high officers agree with him. So this is an interesting situation where, for the first time, perhaps, the ex-military types are cautioning, are quietly saying this is a potential disaster for all concerned, that it's going to increase terrorism, that it's going to endanger our country, that it's going to waste tens or hundreds of billions of dollars, that it's going to get us into a quagmire, that it's going to promote a civil war with huge bloodshed in Iraq itself, that it may spill over the borders. None of this matters to George W. Bush, who confessed to Bob Woodward in his new book that he makes decisions in his gut. He makes decisions by instinct. That may be good or not good for football coaches, but it's a disaster for that kind of anti-reflective attitude to occur at the highest levels of government in the White House.
You most recently wrote about Trent Lott. What do you make of the fact that he's taken down over a statement that he didn't make just for the first time this past year about how the country would have been better off under a segregationist president? But he still remains a power in the Senate, will be made head of the Senate Rules Committee. What does this say about the Republicans and the statement they're making?
Well, what it says, first of all, about American politics is the word is the bad word is more powerful than the bad deeds. It's interesting that Trent Lott lost his position as majority leader because of what he said on one occasion last year, Strom Thurmond's 100th birthday. But not what he's been doing all these years, opposing civil rights, opposing important empowerment programs, opposing campaign reform, opposing any kind of crackdown on the economic crimes in the ghettos, opposing one measure after another, Martin Luther King's birthday. None of this mattered, but the minute he uttered the words, then it mattered. This is something for some mass psychologist or political psychologist to analyze, because it happens again and again and again. People lose their jobs if they say the bad remark, even though they've been reflecting in their deeds the bad remark for years. Secondly, it's the ineptitude of the Democrats that the Republicans have turned the Trent Lott affair into a political plus. They now can say that they sacrificed one of their most powerful politicians because of a crude remark by Trent Lott, and Bill Frist is now in his place, a smiling, charming physician who's extremely conservative, who wants to damage seriously the civil justice system of our country and make it very hard for people injured seriously by medical malpractice and incompetence to have their full day in court. And, you know, Bill Frist volunteers to go to Africa and to perform operations on indigent patients a week or two a year. He's been doing this for a number of years, and yet he is extremely reactionary on many issues. And so the Republicans actually have turned this into a plus. And it's the ineptitude of the Democrats before, during, and after that this is occurring.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, I just want to ask you quickly about the new heads of the committees from the Committee on Environment and Public Works to the Judiciary to the Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, from Edward Kennedy to Judd Gregg, the Republican of New Hampshire. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, speaking with former Green presidential candidate Ralph Nader, consumer activist, talking about what Congress looks like today as it opens. We've got the transfer of heads of committee. For example, the Committee on Environment and Public Works goes from James Jeffords, the independent of Vermont, to James Inhofe, the Republican of Oklahoma. Your thoughts?
Well, first, what the environmental groups should be doing, like the National Resource Defense Council, Environmental Defense Sierra Club, is to hire a couple full-time organizers and put them in Oklahoma. There's too much focus on trying to deal with these reactionary Republicans on Capitol Hill and in the Washington Post. They don't care what's in the Washington Post adverse to them. What they care about, if there's something brewing back in their home state. That is a definite a setback with Inhofe replacing Jeffords. But Shelby replacing Sarbanes, that's a mixed bag. Shelby is much more aggressive on some things in the banking area, safety and soundness issue. He doesn't particularly like the big conglomerate banks. He is a real tough defender of consumer privacy, which deals with a very serious matter in the government today.
Head of the banking committee.
Yeah. And so, you know, in some ways he's going to be better than Sarbanes, and in other ways he's not very good on community reinvestment. McCain taking Hollings' place. McCain is very unfriendly to the civil justice system, although he's worried about federal preemption of states' authority for judges and juries. But on the other hand, he's about to hold the first fuel efficiency hearings in the Senate in quite a while, with the support of Senator John Kerry, because he and Kerry were challenging the auto companies in Detroit last March and lost a bitter fight to modestly advance the amount of mileage that motorists get when they buy new cars, which under their proposal would have been more fuel efficient. So he's going to focus on SUVs. I hope he has Keith Bradshaw, who's the author of the new book, The High and the Mighty, to come and testify.
I'm looking at a piece in the American Prospect. Here they come, a Republican hard rain. Workers of the world duck, moving from Edward Kennedy to Judd Gregg, the incoming chair, Republican senator, has a 2% lifetime voting record on the AFL-CIO's Index of Worker-Related Issues, earned by, among other things, his votes against ergonomic standards and for restricting union political activities.
Yeah, that's a bad bad switch, no doubt. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee, there's an argument that Lugar is better than Biden. Biden said he disagrees very, very little with Senator Lugar. So on policy issues, they're about the same. But Lugar actually is more forceful, appears to be more knowledgeable, and willing to take on the White House more than Biden was.
Finally, Ralph Nader, we're just about to talk about the FCC and about the fact that three of the nation's top TV networks, Fox, NBC, CBS, joined forces to urge the federal government to scrap all remaining media ownership rules. Before we have a debate on the issue with the FCC and Jeff Chester and Bob McChesney, can you share your comments?
Yeah, well, Mr. Powell, who's Colin Powell's son, chairman of the FCC, doesn't seem to know what is in the Communications Act of 1934, which requires the FCC to advance the public interest, necessity, and convenience in managing the public property, which is the public airways, and which is given free and has been since the 1920s to the radio and TV stations. They pay nothing for their license, even though we are the landlords, the people, and they're the tenants. So this is something that is not getting enough attention of citizen groups around the country, even though it'll affect all of them, because putting more and more television radio stations in your city under one corporate conglomerate control has no redeeming value. These communication moguls can't even articulate any listener or viewer advantage to having 3,000 radio stations owned by one company instead of 1,100, which is the situation today, owned by one company. I hope that some of the former Federal Communications Commissioners, like Mr. Lee and Nicholas Johnson and others, will band together to challenge Powell and his narrow majority of 3-2 on the FCC on this, and bring it more attention. But certainly this isn't anything that the networks are going to put on TV, is it? Every time there is any kind of news affecting concentration power in the electronic media, it never appears on the evening news. Even when there's a congressional hearing, the networks ignore it. So it's up to the newspapers and to community radio and to Pacifica to sound the alarm on this situation before we allow four or five giant global conglomerates to decide what we're reading, what we're hearing, and what we're seeing, with the exceptions, a few exceptions of the independent media to the contrary.
Ralph Nader, I want to thank you for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you, Amy. Happy New Year to you and your listeners.
Happy New Year to you, too. Happy News Year as well. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn now to the FCC, last week the three of the nation's top TV networks, Fox, NBC, CBS, joined forces to urge the federal government to scrap the all remaining media ownership rules, coming at a time that the FCC is preparing to fundamentally alter the nation's communications and mass media landscape by rewriting major regulations that affect media ownership. If all the changes being reviewed by the FCC are enacted as proposed, major telecommunications and media corporations will be less regulated and more free to grow than at any time in decades. The networks say the regulations are no longer needed to spur competition among broadcasters, and that the consolidation of television and radio stations had spurred more diversity of programming and local news, not less. Opponents of the regulations fear that the changes could lead to a few powerful conglomerates controlling the flow of electronic information from programming of TV and radio news and entertainment to control of the internet. A review of the regulations is expected to be completed within a few months by the FCC, which is headed by Michael Powell, the son of the Secretary of State, General Colin Powell, which is where we'll begin. Who is Michael Powell? We're joined now by Brendan Kerner, who has written several pieces about Michael Powell for The Village Voice and Mother Jones Magazine. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you with us. Can you just give us a thumbnail sketch of who the son of Colin Powell is?
Yeah, Michael Powell was the youngest FCC commissioner ever when appointed several years ago. And he now is chairman. He's about, I think, 35 years old now. He comes from a decidedly laissez-faire school of economics. Joseph Schumpeter is one of his, I guess you could say, philosophical economic idols. And he's closely allied philosophically with an organization called the Progress and Freedom Foundation, which in the past has advocated abolishing the FCC altogether. So he's certainly a great believer in let the market decide kind of rhetoric.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, I think that his deregulatory bent in terms of media ownership rules and other telecommunications rules is pretty clear in that he wants as few government limits on ownership and as few government limits on the marketplace as possible.
Can you talk about the role of telecommunications giants when it comes to the FCC regulations? For example, where is the money flowing?
Well, I think it comes down to access in terms of FaceTime with the commissioners and their staffs. What I wrote about in the Mother Jones piece was lobbying at the FCC. You would think that a bureaucracy or a bureaucratic agency like the FCC wouldn't face a lot of lobbyists every day, but in fact, that's what the majority of the agenda is taken up with every day at the FCC. It's people coming in saying, here's an issue, here's a rule that we have an interest in. And certainly money and being able to hire a powerful K Street lobbyist is a tremendous factor in one's ability to get FaceTime with an FCC commissioner or an FCC chief of staff. And, you know, certainly if you hear the same message day in, day out, you start to believe that's the right one.
And can you talk about how Michael Powell rose to the position that he's in right now as head of the Federal Communications Commission?
Well, it's pretty simple. When President Bush was elected and was getting ready to, name all the people that would be in his bureaucracy, Powell was a sitting commissioner of the one of the five, and certainly the one who, first of all, had the greatest political ties because of his father, but also I think clearly had the greatest deregulationist sentiments on the commission and would be there for quite a while. There was some debate as to whether Bush would appoint one of his Texas buddies, a guy named Pat Wood, to head the commission. But then in December of 2000, there was a speech that Mr. Powell delivered at the Progress and Freedom Foundation, at which he essentially outlined, how he, his philosophy was in line with this let the market decide, let's get rid of government, government restrictions kind of philosophy so favored by media companies. And taking the podium after Mr. Powell was a congressman named Billy Tozen from Louisiana, who heads the House Commerce Committee, very powerful congressman. And he basically got up there and said, this is the guy I want. That kind of tied Bush's hands, and so he really had to go forward and appoint Mr. Powell because of Tozen's preference.
Any final comments on Michael Powell and the FCC and the kind of money that is now going into the lobbying for change?
Well, I think they have a public comment process, and as your listeners may know, there are something like 1,700 public comments filed against the stripping back of media ownership caps in the past several months. But I think that those public comments are basically just kind of a going through the motions type of thing. I think that corporations who can hire lobbyists to spend time at the FCC, at the portals, the FCC offices in D.C., they're the ones who really drive home the messages that resonate with the commissioners. And I think that that's a sad state of affairs when they're really only getting one side of the debate down there in Washington.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Brendan Koerner, who has written extensively about the FCC, and Michael Powell for Mother Jones Magazine and The Village Voice, among other publications. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn now to a discussion about the FCC's ownership rules. This piece just appeared in the Wall Street Journal on Friday. A letter-writing campaign opposing media consolidation is flooding the electronic mail room of the FCC. It has received nearly 1,700 comments on a proceeding that could result in the agency dismantling many of its media ownership restrictions. Many of the comments stem from a campaign organized by consumer groups which oppose the proposed changes. We're joined right now by four people to talk about the issue of the media ownership rules. Jeffrey Chester is with us, Executive Director of the Center for Digital Democracy. Bob McChesney is author of 8 books on media and politics, a professor of communications at the University of Illinois. Mara Einstein is with us, Assistant Professor of Media Studies at Queens College. Her study, Program Diversity and the Program Selection Process on Broadcast Network Television, was one of 10 studies cited by the Federal Communications Commission when it drafted its media ownership regulations. And we're also joined by a spokesperson for the FCC. He will talk about the FCC's position right now. And he is Ken Faree, chief of the Media Bureau of the Federal Communications Commission. Can you start off by talking, Ken Faree, about the broadcast ownership rules at the FCC? Are you with us?
All right, can you hear me? I'm with you.
Yes, I can hear you now.
Okay, happy to do that. You know, just to provide your listeners with some context, I think they should understand that these rules date back into the mists of time. Most of them were adopted, in fact, all of them were adopted between 1941 and 1975, and they've not been significantly overhauled since then. In 1996, Congress stepped in and said, FCC, you have to go and take a serious look at these rules in today's marketplace, because obviously the media world has changed dramatically in the last 40 years. And you have to decide whether these rules are still necessary and show us why. Previous commissions have made a couple of attempts to do that, frankly, sort of half-hearted attempts, and just invoked the magic words from the statute and said, yes, we think these rules are still necessary. We've gone to court on a couple of these. In fact, 4 of the rules have been taken to court, and all 4 of them the FCC has lost on. Courts have reversed and vacated 4 of our 8 broadcast ownership rules now. And I have every confidence that if we sit back and just keep invoking the magic words and saying, yes, we think these are still necessary, the other 4 rules also will be vacated by the courts. So this, we have no choice about doing this. At this point, we can either do nothing and have the rules go away, essentially, or we can go out and actually do what we're trying to do, do the hard work, look at the media marketplace today, see how consumers use media, how they substitute between different sorts of media, and try to write rules that we can then go to court on, because believe me, we will be sued when this process is over. We will be back in court, and we will be able to stand up and say, Your Honor, these are the rules that we need to ensure that the media marketplace remains diverse and competitive, and here's why. And this is an empirical analysis. This is not an emotional project we're on. It's not a political project we're on. It's purely scientific, and you can measure concentration empirically, and that's what we're trying to do now.
Robert McChesney, your response.
Well, I think he's absolutely right in a very narrow technical sense. The courts have said that Congress in the 1996 Telecom Act did indeed authorize the FCC to revisit and evaluate these ownership rules. But I think to leave it there does a great disservice to the truth. I mean, the fact of the matter is that Congress itself, when it passed this regulation in the 1996 Act, most members of Congress had no idea that it was even in the law. They didn't even understand the law. I've spoken to members of the actual committee in the House that draft the law. He didn't even understand it was there. This is really what the courts have said is that this is an issue ultimately that Congress has resolved. And as he's saying, the FCC responds to the dictates of Congress ultimately. They give it the directions. And he's right. Congress needs to revisit this issue itself. It has done a terrible job due to largely corrupt political factors of addressing this issue. But that doesn't mean the FCC should just put on its blinders and plow ahead and sort of give away the store because Congress has been corruptly bought off and the courts have basically gone along with it. that would be a tremendous abdication of their responsibility to serve the public interest.
What do you think needs to be done? You're saying, yes, there needs to be change.
I think there are members of the FCC, fortunately, like Michael Copps, who understand the historical importance of this, that the assumption that the market works, unless you come up with overwhelming evidence that it doesn't work, that it's the natural system, is a dubious assumption. There's no historical precedent for that assumption. And that instead, the burden of proof should be the opposite. The burden of proof should be that if you deregulate, let the toothpaste out of the tube, that things will get better, not that they won't get worse. And that indeed what is needed is exactly what the powerful commercial interests have done everything in their power to prevent, which is a genuine, wide-open, long-range public study and debate of the issue, not done behind closed doors, not done just by the superstar lobbyists, but involving the Congress and the entire population of the country. And unless we do that, we're going to have a classic case. We're going to come up with policies that serve those who make them. If you're not at the table, you're not part of the deal, the old saying goes. And this is a classic case where the people at the table are just the big, powerful, wealthy, special interest lobbyists. And then they can hire a lot of slick PR people to tell us how this is all about free markets, when in fact this has nothing to do with free markets. These are the most unfree, uncompetitive markets in the country. These are markets that are set up by the government. The government picked the winners when they handed out these licenses for television stations. There's nothing about a free market competition to get these licenses. And then once they get these valuable government gifts, these monopoly rights that are granted to them but no charge by the government, then they turn around and say any effort to like get something in return from the government for these monopoly licenses is regulation, when in fact the whole system is built on regulation. The issue isn't whether we're going to have regulation, it's whether who's the regulations going to be for. We're either going to have it for the public and the people, or we're just going to have it to suit the interests of these private companies, and that's where we're heading right now.
Bob McChesney and Ken Furrie, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, and we'll also be joined by our other guests as well. Stay with us.
Six foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground, another pirate station. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listener supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listener supported.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, Michael Franti, listener supported. We're talking about the FCC ownership rules, rules on delivering news and entertainment to the public are on the verge of a broad overhaul that could pave the way for more media mergers and alter the landscape of television and radio programming. We're talking to Robert McChesney, author of many books on media and politics, as well as Ken Furrie, who is a spokesperson for the Federal Communications Commission. Joining us will be Jeff Chester, who's with the Center for Digital Democracy. We're also joined by Professor Mara Einstein, who wrote a study that the FCC has cited in drafting its new media ownership regulations. Ken Furrie, you wanted to respond, and then I want to go to Mara Einstein's study.
Sure, yeah, I had just had a brief response. I mean, Bob may wish that the presumptions were reversed, but that's just not the law now, and I have to deal in the real world with the actual law that we have today, which is that if we can't justify a rule, it goes away. And that's where we are. So far, we've had four rules reversed, and we have four left. We're trying to figure out if we can find a way to justify those or some other rules that will actually serve the interest that Bob was talking about. I would also say that this notion that somehow this is all about lobbying and money is just a canard. This is really about law and science. And if we were on this sort of political mission that Bob has alleged that we're on, it'd be the easiest thing in the world for us to sit back and do nothing and just let the courts vacate these rules.
Well, let me bring Jeff Chester in from the Center for Digital Democracy. Your response to Ken Furrie saying this isn't about politics, it's about law and science.
There's a massive media land grab going on right now. It's been building over 20 years. It's part of a powerful political effort by the nation's largest media companies to, in essence, dominate both old and new media. I think it's very important for your listeners, for progressives in particular, to understand that even though this proceeding deals with newspapers and television and radio, it's part of a much larger initiative underway by these companies and by the FCC that will allow these same companies to dominate cable television and to shape the future of the Internet as well. And it's also related to media industry efforts to remove rights that the public has to make copies of material. It relates to no limits on the ability of companies to collect data in terms of privacy. So there's a broad battle going on about what the future of our sort of digital democracy will look like. It's all related to money and power. The FCC is nothing more really than an extension of the industry. There's not one former chairperson of the FCC who is not working now lobbying the FCC, more or less. But the real key here is Congress. I mean, you can file at the FCC, but the FCC's mind is made up. Michael Powell's mind is made up no matter what we file. And I'm very pleased to say that for the first time in many years, a broad coalition of groups, including the AFL-CIO and the Newspaper Guild and the Writers Guild of America East and West and AFTRA, the people that write and produce and create all of the entertainment programming we see, much of the news that we see, and write all of the journalism that we get in the nation's media, they have all filed and they have told the FCC there is no competition, there is no diversity. And you know what? That won't have any impact. But what your listeners need to do is to yell and scream to their members of Congress, to their senators, because only through congressional pressure can we either slow down or reshape what the FCC and Mr. Powell intends to do.
Well, three of the nation's top TV networks have urged the federal government to scrap all remaining media ownership rules, saying they're no longer needed to spur competition and ensure diversity. In a lengthy filing last Thursday with the FCC, Fox, NBC, CBS cited 8 privately funded studies that they said showed how consolidation of TV and radio stations had spurred more diversity in programming and local news, not less. Mara Einstein is a professor of media studies at Queens College. Your findings?
My study was specifically about the financial interest in syndication rules and to see whether or not there was a change in program diversity on the broadcast networks before the time the rules were instituted, during the time the rules were in place, and then what happened after the rules were repealed. What I did was look at the diversity of programming on primetime programming and then look at that in relationship to the consolidation of the industry. And what I found, and this is where this study has been misquoted and actually quite frankly attacked, is it said that the conclusion of the study is that there exists a diversity of programs. That's not specifically what I said. What I said was that the diversity hasn't changed, that there's been sort of a middling level of diversity when the rules were in place and when the rules were repealed. It went repealed, went up slightly, but we still have a sort of middle level of diversity. And my contention is that has to do with the revenue model, because we're dependent upon advertising in order to support programming that exists on the air. And as long as we are dependent on advertising to support the programming, it becomes incumbent to aggregate eyeballs, to create large audiences in order to be able to support the programming. And as long as that's the economic model, we're going to have the same kind of programming, whether or not we have a lot of independent producers creating programming or we have these consolidated network/program producers.
Jeff Chester.
Look, there have been a number of studies that have refuted what Professor Einstein has written, and I urge people to read, for example, the Writers Guild of America West study, which is on my website and available elsewhere. When you had some safeguards in place, you know, you assured that independent producers, people like Norman Lear, all in the family, that program could never have been made under today's policies and rules. So there's only, you know, 5 companies really controlling the majority of what we see on all of the cable channels that we have, and on broadcast television. There's absolutely no diversity. There need to be a series of safeguards. There's no public interest safeguards being proposed here by the FCC, and that's one of the dangers for progressives. The ownership of the mass media, old and new, in fewer hands, all focused on marketing and advertising. That is their sole vision. We'll create a generation of folks more focused on satisfying themselves than being involved in the kind of democratic debate and engagement that we desperately need in this country. So without a fight to ensure that we can have a media system that's more open and more diverse, including the Internet, progressive voices will grow dimmer, I fear. And that's why I hope everyone will speak out now from the progressive community.
Mm. Well, Ken Furey, what chance do people have to speak out to be heard? What about this Wall Street Journal piece saying that the FCC was flooded with letters and electronic mail receiving 1,700 comments on this proceeding, basically against the media consolidation rules?
Well, I mean, we have received a lot of comments. I haven't been through them all. I don't know what percentage were, you know, how they fall, and I'm sure we'll receive hundreds, if not thousands more, which sort of belies the kind of picture that Jeff would like to paint of this world. I don't know what world he lives in. I can't find a person today that has fewer media choices available to them or less diverse programming available to them than they did 10 or 20 or 30 years ago, and I have every expectation that we'll see an increasing specialization in microization of media. We're getting away from mass media and into a world of mini media where everybody gets what they want when they want it, and it's not in the control of big government or big companies, but it's in every person's control. Now, we have the same concerns that Jeff has and that Bob has. We're trying to ensure that there is a media market out there that's diverse and competitive, but we have to do this scientifically, and we can't just go in there and say, we think these things are necessary. That's not good enough anymore. The courts don't care what we think. The courts want facts. They want evidence. And I don't think we should be afraid of the facts. I think the facts actually will help us in this case.
Yeah, Bob McChesney.
Well, you know, I just think it'd be nice if he would not call his own work scientific and everyone else sort of unscientific, because that's not really the case. It's not like he's got the facts and we're tossing out a lot of metaphysics here. The facts are also these. The range of debate that he bases his science on are a range of debate set in Congress and at the SEC by powerful special interests. That's why he starts from the assumption that having a handful of very profitable corporations is benevolent and a good thing. That's not a natural thing. That doesn't come from the Constitution or the Founding Fathers or the Bill of Rights. That comes from a range of debate in Congress set by extraordinarily powerful lobbies who have everything to dictate the nature of how our media policies are drafted. That's true. That's a fact. That's science, if you want science. But if you accept that as natural, as God's gift, like a mountain range or something, then you can say you're scientific in trying to come up with a system that serves those interests. But there's nothing scientific about that. That's just a policy that's corrupt.
That's why, this is Jeff Chess, that's why I say this is a done deal. Because, look, the FCC issued some studies from Mr. Ferry's department. Those studies were attacked, including Ms. Einstein's study, as being inaccurate and poorly prepared. We have now filed studies. The Consumer Federation of America, all the public interest groups have filed empirical studies. I urge people to read the Writers Guild of America West study to really see who's in control. It doesn't make a difference what we provide the FCC, because ultimately it's a political decision. With all due respect to Ken, who likes to think he's independent, there's an ideological fix in place. And frankly, even though we have the most activist Democrat on the FCC in decades, Michael Copps, the fact is that under the Democrat chair and Republicans chair, the FCC is usually an extension of the industry. It was Bill Clinton who appointed Michael Powell to begin with. John McCain is Michael Powell's political godfather. Bob McChesney is right. We ultimately need Congress to rewrite the media ownership rules, and the public interest community needs to put on a better fight here in the short term with this proceeding and the long term in terms of getting new public policies in place to keep the Internet open.
What about hearings or any public hearings coming up?
There's going to be Columbia University. Look, the FCC has simply failed here. I mean, the reason you're getting these 1,700 comments is that people like myself and Fairness and Action Reporting and others have sort of stepped in where the FCC has failed. The FCC should be going out, holding hearings across the country. In their own words, in Ken's own words, we're talking about rearranging the celestial arrangement so to speak, of communications in this country. It's the most important proceeding, in their own words, in decades, yet they have not gone out to let people know about it, you know, which is why we've been begging people to write about it. You see in today's New York Times, Bill Kovich has written about it. Columbia University and University of Southern California have stepped in. There's going to be a public forum in New York City on January 16th, run by Columbia University. There's going to be another another hearing at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School, scheduled for February 18th. Mr. McChesney will be, I think, participating in the New York event, I understand. But, you know, the FCC under Michael Powell has scheduled one lone hearing in Richmond, Virginia, the week of February 10th. That's not good enough. This is going to affect every city. This is going to affect every state. It's going to affect our democracy. It's going to affect our economy, you know, and it's so critically important. And I think it says a lot that the FCC under Mr. Powell and Mr. Ferry simply refused to go out and urge for the kind of coverage and debate and independent discourse necessary for this most important decision for our...
Ken Furey, where are the public hearings?
Yeah, that's a good point. Thank you. It's Furey, by the way, Jeff. We've debated a number of
I'm
times.
I'm sorry, Ken.
I know you know that's how you pronounce my last
name. No, I often get that wrong.
You know, you highlight the difference, I think, in the way we look at the world. I mean, this is 2003 now. We don't need to get on a steam engine and go on a whistle-stop tour to find out what the American people want. People today have better access to everything we've done, to our proposals, to our studies, to the studies that have been filed by others than they've ever had before, and better access. They can communicate directly with us. They can write. They can email directly to me. I mean, this is really a world in which there's far better access and far better opportunity for public participation in this process.
Your email address, Mr. Furey?
Never been.
Your email address, you said people could write directly to you.
www.fcc.gov, and there's a Media Bureau page you can find, and it has the proceeding in it, and it has everything that's been filed.
But look, listen, people should come to www.democraticmedia.org or FAIR, F-A-I-R, .org. There are other websites as well. At our website, we explain what the FCC is saying and list sort of 10 points that they make, which we think are completely ludicrous. Look, Ken, this requires a serious debate in every major city and many small communities across the country. It has to be outside the Beltway because it's not about Washington. It's about the entire nation. The fact that the FCC doesn't see it, that Michael Powell and Ken doesn't really see the need to come out, says a lot. They're trapped by the political gravity that McChesney talked about.
If I can add one thing about that, Jeff, I give talks around the country, and I think it's safe to say that well over 98 or 99% of the American population has no idea this is going on whatsoever. So just having the chance to send an email to Ken doesn't amount to a hill of beans in the real world he loves to invoke.
In this last minute, what do you think are the most effective ways? And I'll ask you each this. You each get 10 seconds for what people can do, and is this a done deal?
Who are you starting with?
I'll start with Ken Furey.
Sure, thanks. No, it's not a done deal. We're in the middle of this process. I'll tell you, it's a lot of hard work, and if we really wanted to do what they...
How can people best be heard? We just have 5 seconds. How can they be heard?
www.fcc.gov.
What's the actual email address?
Can they write to you, Ken, or somebody?
Well, through the website, you probably can.
Actually, you go through the website, and there's a way to file on the website. It's pretty self-explanatory.
Bob McChesney.
Well, I think contact the SEC, like Ken just said, but also contact your member of Congress and let them know they've got to stop this. They've got to have real public hearings. It's absolutely mandatory to get Congress awake on this issue.
Mara Einstein.
I would agree with what everyone else says, but I would also say, just in response to something that Jeff Chester said earlier,
10 seconds.
Is bear in mind who else is doing those studies, and the studies from the Writers Guild, they're concerned about jobs, which is a legitimate concern, but source diversity is not the same thing as viewpoint diversity.
Well, Jeff Chester, last one.
Come to www.democraticmedia.org. There you can file comments directly with the FCC and send letters to your members of Congress. I urge you to do so. Call Congress. Stop this deregulation. regulatory move.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us, and that does it for today's program. We will certainly continue to follow what the Federal Communications Commission is doing. If you want to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. Our email address is mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Nogueira, Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.